Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. The big Hollywood news this week is that comedian and actor Gilbert Gottfried passed away at the young age of 67. His cause of death was revealed as a rare genetic muscle disease that does impact your heart. We're told that the legendary comic died Tuesday from a recurrent issue that was due to myotonic dystrophy type 2, which has been described as an inherited dystrophy that affects the muscles and other systems, which could mean your heart, and in his case, a result of an abnormal heartbeat. So I wanted to understand this a little bit better. Again, it is rare, but it's something that I think it's just interesting to learn about things in the health sector that we're not familiar with, but it is making headlines this morning. So joining me to talk a little bit about this is Dr. Zara Khan. Dr. Khan is a neurologist who specializes in neuromuscular disorders at St. Vincent's Medical Center, and Dr. Khan is here right now. Good morning, Doc. Thank you for being here.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
So could you go into just the basic of what exactly is myotonic dystrophy type 2?
So basically, myotonic dystrophy is a multi-system genetic disorder that affects your muscles as well as other organs. And there are two distinct types of it, type 1 and type 2. The myotonia in the word myotonic dystrophy refers to inability to relax your muscles after contraction. So, for example, patients may see their hands get stuck on doorknobs. They may have difficulty opening their eyelids after closing. And then the dystrophy refers to, it's a common term that refers to degeneration of tissues. And in this case, it refers to degeneration of muscles. So type 2 myotonic dystrophy is a milder form of the two types that can affect anyone from their teen years to mid-adulthood. And there is a common set of characteristics between the two myotonic dystrophies, and these patients have early onset cataracts before the age of 50. They have myotonia, which is the inability to relax muscles, and they have a distinct pattern of muscle weakness that differs between the two types.
So forgive me for probably sounding incorrect in saying this, but it sort of sounds like a slower paced ALS.
Yes, this is completely different than ALS. ALS also is a neuromuscular disorder, but the pathophysiology is completely different, even though the difficulties that they may have, manifestations such as progressive muscle weakness and decline, may be a common theme. And ALS is not genetic. This is an autosomal dominant, inherited condition.
Okay. So for just to clarify, what is the difference between the two, not ALS and what we're talking about, but when you have something genetically versus you're saying ALS is something that, where does like that come from?
So we don't exactly know the pathophysiology. It occurs sporadically majority of the time. There is an inherited form of ALS as well, but that's exceedingly rare. We don't know what causes someone or predisposes someone to develop ALS.
Okay. We're talking this morning to Dr. Khan, a neurologist who specializes in neuromuscular disorders at St. V's, and we're talking about myotonic dystrophy because it's something that is basically being called the cause of the demise of Gilbert Gottfried, the very well-known actor and comedian. So it sounds like with this, Doc, it's very rare is what we keep hearing. It's very rare. But who is at risk of getting it? It sounds like it's genetic. So is that something you could test for?
Yeah, so I don't think it's exceedingly rare.
Okay.
So type 1 may be, a little bit more rare. It's a more, let me just give you an overview of the both types, and then I'll give you my thoughts on the prevalence.
Yeah.
So type 1, you could see it 1 in 2,500 people. And it depends on the population as well, I guess, where you're testing it. Type 1 is easily recognized, so we are much more familiar with its prevalence because the patients who have type 1 myotonic dystrophy have a very distinct phenotype, which means physically their appearance is very distinct. So before you even start testing them, there is, you know, you already know that they probably have type 1 myotonic dystrophy. Type 2 myotonic dystrophy patients, however, can appear completely normal in physical appearance. They don't even have any cognitive impairment that type 1 patients have.
Interesting.
I think the problem is that you have to have a very high index of suspicion for these kind of people, and I think it's underdiagnosed and underrecognized. So we don't
really
know the true prevalence. Yeah.
Wow. Because, you know, that's just it. You read all over, and these are credible sources. It's not like they're not credible sources, but you're reading everywhere, you know, this rare disease. This is why I think it's so important that we have these kinds of segments with St. V's after you hear about, you know, we talked about Bruce Willis a week ago and really understanding his diagnosis. And with this, that was the thing that I thought was interesting to me, was that it kept being, and it still is. I just read that straight from a headline this morning, you know, this rare illness. But, you know, you said 1 in 2,500. That's not rare. I wouldn't call that rare. I think that's, you got, I don't think so either.
Yeah. We have MDA clinics all over U.S., you know, and majority of the patients in those MDA clinics have type 1 or type 2 myotonic dystrophy. Granted, for me, it's probably also not rare because I specialize in this and I see it a lot more than an average physician. So, but yeah, I don't think it's as rare as is being depicted.
Interesting. We're chatting this morning with Dr. Zara Khan, who is a neurologist who specializes in neuromuscular disorders at St. Vincent's Medical Center. And we're talking about myotonic dystrophy type 2, which was the alleged cause of the death of comedian Gilbert Gottfried. The only reason I say alleged is because we have not heard from a medical examiner on this yet. A very close family friend and the family of Gilbert Gottfried did tell reporters that it's all over. But again, until I hear from a medical examiner, I'm just saying that's the apparent cause of death. In the meantime, though, I wanted to learn a little bit more about this because I was reading, actually, Dr. Khan, that this is something that could be diagnosed in somebody in their 20s or 30s, at least type 2 could be diagnosed in your 20s or 30s. So am I to believe that you could have a normal childhood and even your teenage years and then, you know, post-college, all of a sudden you start to feel something different with your muscle tension? Am I correct in that, or is that not accurate, what I read?
Partially accurate. So type 2 myotonic dystrophy can manifest anytime between adolescence, so in your teenage years, to mid-adulthood. And type 1 can manifest at any age.
Wow.
So, yeah, you can have a completely normal childhood with type 2 myotonic dystrophy and not realize, and you know, you're in mid-teens or mid-adulthood, and it can manifest at that time.
Wow. We had a question from a listener. Great question. What's the difference between myotonic dystrophy and Parkinson's?
So Parkinson's is a movement disorder. Myotonic dystrophy is primarily a muscle disorder. And with Parkinson's disease, you basically have difficulty moving. Everything becomes significantly slow. People have rigidity as well. Other features include tremor. So it doesn't include degeneration of muscle tissue. It has a very different pathophysiology than myotonic dystrophy.
Because with Parkinson's,
Okay. So Parkinson's is most of the time it's seen in elderly patients, but can occur at a younger age as well. It also has, you know, like a broad broad age range, basically, in which it affects it mostly. It's, 50s and above, 60s mostly, and leads to patients having gait problems, difficulty walking, and tremors. And when it's severe enough, later in the disease process, can lead to falls, trouble with swallowing and whatnot.
Okay. Because really with the dystrophy, that's like a muscle tensing. It's almost like it stops versus you're saying the muscle movement. You're talking about a movement issue with Parkinson's.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So you have an accelerator and think of it as an accelerator and brakes in your brain. So that entire system that allows you to move at a normal pace or to run and to coordinate movements, that's the part that's getting affected in Parkinson's. Whereas, myotonic dystrophy is more peripheral problem affecting the muscles.
And my understanding, too, Dr. Khan, is that with myotonic dystrophy, it's something that can then impact something as major as your heart, which is what it sounds like happened with Gilbert Gottfried, was that it impacted his heart and made like an irregular heartbeat, is what it sounds like. It sounds like another aspect of this is that it goes from the muscles to major parts of the body, like a heart or a pancreas or even the eyes, is what I was reading.
Absolutely. So like I said, it's a multi-system genetic disorder. So, you have different types of muscles in your body, skeletal muscles, which are the voluntary muscles that we use to move around. Then you have the cardiac muscle, which we don't have much control over. And then the smooth muscle that basically lines your gut and whatnot. So all of those muscles are affected in myotonic dystrophy. So it's not a surprise that cardiac conduction defects, basically the electrical activity of the heart, 90% of the time is abnormal in type 1 and frequently can be abnormal in type 2, although the cardiac conduction defects are much less severe in type 2, but both can nonetheless lead to fatal arrhythmias causing sudden cardiac death.
Mm. Gilbert Gottfried died at 67 years old. Is that pretty common? Like, I mean, to me, that's pretty young to be dying at 67. What would you say for myotonic dystrophy? Do people typically have a long lifespan? Are there treatments to prolong it? Or is that right about the age that, unfortunately, we see people pass from this?
So what I can say, I'm going to give you a more generalized answer. Hard to tell what age, one may live up to. So in type 1, because the conduction defects are much more common, they tend to be more severe. And the longer the duration of disease you have with age, and particularly in males, the higher the risk of having these conduction defects and fatal arrhythmias. So the type 1 patients have a shorter lifespan, unfortunately, because of this, whereas the type 2 patients tend to live longer, but they're obviously also at risk of dying due to these arrhythmias. But they tend to have better lifespans than type 1.
And are there treatments for it?
Unfortunately, we don't have any treatment or a cure for this condition, but there are things that you can do to ensure patient safety. That's number one. So these patients belong in a multidisciplinary clinic where you can address all their needs. Because it's a multi-system disorder, you want all the specialists in the same clinic so they can address all the needs that these patients have, including cardiologists, gastroenterologists, neurologists, ophthalmologists, the rehab doctors, pulmonologists, just to name a few.
Yeah, a one-stop shop almost. Yeah.
Yes. And then you can control their symptoms. Myotonia, if it is really bothersome for them, we do have some medications that target sodium channels. And that can be used, but a lot of times they don't even realize they have myotonia, or it's not very bothersome to them. So that's an option. The other thing they can do is moderate intensity aerobic exercises are recommended for these folks, so they're encouraged to do that. But other than that, we don't have particular targeted treatments. The key is to have these people undergo screening tests, particularly cardiac, as well as ophthalmologic screening tests, so that you can identify the cardiac arrhythmias early on and to see what steps need to be taken after that.
Interesting. Dr. Khan, I learned a lot about this. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning to explain it to me and my listeners. We appreciate it.
Of course. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Khan with St. Vincent's Medical Center here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning spends a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. Thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me. Hope you're well, too.
Yes. Thank you so much for asking. I think I was seeing on your Twitter page recently, maybe it was yesterday, that you were talking about the Carpenters Union and combating worker exploitation by construction companies who misclassify employees as independent contractors, don't pay fair wages, refuse to provide workers with compensation if they get hurt on the job. And not to say that this is directly connected whatsoever, I want to make that very clear, but I just think this is a very incredible time to be talking about this because we're just a little over a week away from the L'Ambiance collapse in Bridgeport. And it's always around this time of year that I'm thinking about construction workers and contractors and just their safety on the job. Could you talk a little bit about the work you're doing with Carpenters Union?
Sure, Melissa. And this topic is really so important and so gut-wrenching when we think about L'Ambiance Plaza, which was designed and built with a really defective method of construction, the so-called lift slab method, where floors are lifted and placed, fully constructed atop one another. In L'Ambiance Plaza, the floors fell, crushing workers who were there, who came to work that day, left their families, expect to go home at night, and of course never did. Mm-hmm. So it is a tragedy that is the result of failure to properly design and construct at the behest of the construction company and putting workers in danger as a result. And in fact, the lift slab method of construction was banned after this tragedy. It should have been banned beforehand. But the issue of worker safety is absolutely front and center as we think about L'Ambiance Plaza. And likewise with the carpenters, this misclassification of workers as contractors means they don't get the benefits of workers' compensation, health benefits, other kinds of really benefits that other workers receive as a matter of course. If they're independent contractors, they're not employees. They have to take care of their own health insurance if they're going to get it, their own other kinds of benefits. And so it's a way of construction companies avoiding the additional cost of treating those workers fairly. And that's the point here. They should be treated fairly. Safety should be number one priority. The standards may be diluted if they're independent contractors. And so the two are related, not directly. But the point is, ultimately, we may be defrauded. We as taxpayers may be defrauded because the construction companies aren't paying Social Security. They're not paying taxes, submitting all the other kinds of record keeping that results in proper taxes being imposed.
Mm. Do you think any of the reasons, Senator Blumenthal, for maybe not the best conditions for the construction industry is because there are, and I could be wrong in the amount of, I don't know how many people, but there are a lot of people who enter the construction industry who maybe either it came over from another country and maybe don't have their U.S. citizenship just yet, or they could be paid under the table, or essentially they could be taken advantage of, I'm going to put it bluntly, that construction companies could take advantage of workers because they could get cheap labor, for example. Do you find that that's a contributing factor to why there's such an issue with this industry, or no?
It could be. We have no reliable statistics, but certainly there are construction companies, and hopefully they're just a minority, and most construction companies do the right thing, follow the law, treat their workers fairly. I'm talking about a minority, maybe a small minority, but still, it's important because exploiting undocumented immigrants or people who are United States citizens could happen without proper enforcement. That's what really should be done. The law should be enforced if the construction companies and contractors are not obeying it.
So, I mean, at this point, Senator Blumenthal, what can be done? Because I think you and I have actually talked about this issue in the past before, nothing recently, but I think you and I have talked about this once or twice before. What can really be done to better the situation?
That's really the key question. What can be done is for the federal government to enforce the law more rigorously. I'm going to be writing to federal authorities, whether the Department of Labor or the Department of Justice, having met with carpenters' representatives. The union that represents them has been vigilant, and I'm very hopeful that we can work with the union, that federal authorities will investigate, but also the state of Connecticut. The Department of Labor here in Connecticut has a responsibility as well. I hope it will look into this misclassification. And again, misclassification is a sort of complicated word for the practice of misclassifying workers as independent contractors, not employees, so that they're supposedly just working on their own independently, working for themselves, and they happen to come to work at this site, as opposed to employees who should be treated with all the benefits of employment, Social Security, unemployment compensation, other kinds of health benefits that they're entitled to receive, and the vigilance and vigor in following the law. And I will just say one more thing about the carpenters. You know, the union has an apprenticeship program that is really, really impressive. We need more people with these skills, whether it's carpenter skills or electrician, pipe fitters, all of the trades. Carpenters are really ahead of the curve in their apprenticeship program, which they call the best four-year college in the country. I kind of agree, because you're an apprentice for 4 years, then you become certified or licensed as a carpenter. In those 4 years, you're earning while you learn, earn while you learn. And at the end of 4 years of apprenticeship, it's like a college, it's 4 years, but at the end of it, you have a skill and training that gives you a career. Mm. And that's really very, very important to our entire economy, because we need those folks with skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, Senator Blumenthal, we appreciate you talking about it this morning and for sharing it on your social media as well. And we'll talk again next week.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Melissa. Take care.
Fairfield and Bridgeport announced an environmental rehabilitation of Ash Creek Sandbar, as well as a partnership for flood prevention projects. So I wanted to learn a little bit more about this. First Selectwoman Brenda Kupchick is back on the show in Fairfield. Good morning, Brenda. I've missed you. How are you?
I'm good. I've missed you, too. We haven't talked in a while.
I know. It's been crazy. It's been crazy busy, but I'm so glad to have you back on the show. When I saw this email pop up yesterday, I thought, oh, Brenda, great. Let me get her on the show immediately. And I mean, it sounds like a really great partnership. First of all, where did this come to be?
So, the Ash Creek Conservation Group reached out. The association reached out to our town several months back now, talking about this issue with us, you know, because we border each other. So Fairfield and Bridgeport meet right there where Ash Creek and our Fairfield Marina and Beach area is. Mm-hmm. And so they said, you know, there's a degradation of the sand spit. And they came in, we had our conservation director come in, and we met and we discussed the project. And they asked if we would be willing to put in some money to restore, to plant 40 plugs of a specific specified grass that helps with flood and erosion in that area, because it really needed it. So we put our heads together, our engineering departments, our conservation departments, And we both took some of the ARPA funds that we got and partnered and went through the process together. And I was really proud to stand there yesterday and watch all those beautiful plants planted along the spit there to protect not only the ecological issues that are, you know, that we want to protect, but also the homeowners in the area from flooding.
It's, and, you know, in the photos that were sent to the media, it is, it really is beautiful. I'm curious. So how much was needed? You said there was specified grass essentially that was needed for this. Do you know how much ballpark you needed and how much was that going to cost? I know you guys used federal funding, but how much was needed and how much did it cost you guys?
So it was 40,000 plugs. They're very, you know, they're not large, but they're going to grow. And it was approximately 35,000 on each side.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Wow.
For each town.
Okay. 35,000 for each town.
And this
wow.
is just the first part. So we're going to partner and add some more diverse plants. And obviously, I'm not a conservation person, but they know and have discussed both sides, Bridgeport and Fairfield, about adding to it as we go along with more diverse plantings to be able to, you know, continue the project of making sure that that's a stable area and that we are protecting the wildlife and the estuary, as well as, you know, mitigating flooding.
Mm-hmm. And Brenda Kupchick is here for Select Woman of Fairfield. There was a big announcement yesterday that she and Mayor Ganim shook hands on this environmental rehabilitation of Ash Creek Sandbar. And I'm curious, you know, are there other areas now that this has been done, Brenda, are there other areas that need to be tackled? Because as you mentioned, you've got Fairfield and Bridgeport both right there on the Sound. I mean, you guys are both, like you said, you're neighboring each other, but you have very big communities that both live right there on Long Island Sound.
Well, we are partnering on another matter, another flooding issue. It's not about the Sound. It's about the Rooster River. So the Rooster River runs all the way from Trumbull down through Bridgeport and Fairfield, and we border each other all along this river, Bridgeport and Fairfield. So we are both the most impacted by it. And so this has been going on for about 20 years. So when I came in, I was aware of the issue. And when we got the ARPA funds, the town of Fairfield already had engineering plans on the shelf waiting to go as a capital expenditure to try to do some mitigation to those areas. And, you know, as we both know, we are seeing so much more extreme weather events.
Oh, sure.
We're seeing the rain that we get at times now in Connecticut. It comes down so quickly, it overwhelms all the sewers and everything else. And the Rooster River has been flooding even before these weather events, and it just has gotten to a critical point where people's houses are being flooded out repeatedly. So
wow.
I reached out to Bridgeport and I said, well, what do you think about using some of your ARPA funds to assist us with this Rooster River Phase 1 project? And they were great. They were like, yes, we're in. So we put in $3.2 million and they added $750,000 toward this plan that we have. And that their $750,000 is going to cover some catch basins up where the Fairchild Wheeler golf course is, because we have the flooding starts sort of up there. And if you put these basins in, again, I'm not an engineer, but I've been in a lot of meetings learning about this over the past
year. I'm sure you have, sure.
So they put these catch basins in, and this is supposed to mitigate the flooding. And we're also putting, well, detention basins are called. And we have some, we're putting in a lot of other mitigation efforts all along Fairfield and Bridgeport's border, where is exactly where the Rooster River is. It literally, it runs across our border.
Wow.
And it impacts Bridgeport residents as well as Fairfield residents. So I think this is going to be, you know, the beginning of some good joint projects between the two cities. And like I said yesterday, you know, I think it's sort of I think it's a nice thing to sort of show that, you know, people from cities and towns that are bordering each other, and even, you know, from different parties yeah. can work together.
Right. It's
to do something good.
I think that was kind of why I was also excited about it, you know, because you'll hear about Fairfield, you know, partnering with Westport or partnering with Easton and Bridgeport partnering with Stratford or Trumbull. And it was nice. I got to be honest. It's funny you just said that, because that was my first thought when I saw you and Mayor Ganim together. Not that you guys have never had a good relationship, but I thought, oh, that's different. That's fun seeing these two come together. I thought the same thing. That's so funny you say that.
I actually said that yesterday before I made my comments about the Sanspit, that I hope this is a nice example for our national and state politicians to be able to see that two parties can work together for the greater good of the community.
Yeah, it's so true. We're chatting this morning with First Electwoman Brenda Kupchick of Fairfield. A big announcement this week from both Bridgeport and Fairfield. The two entities are working together on environmental rehabilitation of Ash Creek Sandbar, but also doing a partnership for flood prevention projects. And specifically, Brenda and I were just talking about the Rooster River and how that literally is right between Fairfield and Bridgeport, and how it has been impacting for almost two decades a lot of the people living there. And it's only getting worse because of the weather that we've been experiencing lately. It's getting harder and harder to control that. Here's my question for you, Brenda, if you don't mind me asking. You had said to fund the work at Ash Creek Sandbar. That was ARPA funding you guys used?
Right. So each of us got ARPA funding, and specifically we had voted to use for flood mitigation for different things. So there was ARPA funds for both projects. So when they came to us, we used some of our ARPA funds to work on this project, as did they.
Okay. This isn't to be controversial. I truly am just trying to understand it. How do you guys get the approval for that when that's like, isn't it supposed to be specifically connected to COVID? And if this was an issue before COVID or it has nothing really to do with it,
how did they
get the approval for it? Or am I wrong? I might be wrong.
No. The ARPA funds were not specifically related to COVID.
Okay.
It was a federal bill that was sent down to each of the each of the states, and then each of the towns got a specific amount. Fairfield got $24.8 million, and we went through, you know, a very rigorous process. Our finance department reviewed all the information associated with the money, because obviously anytime you take federal or state money, there's a lot of rules and regulations you have to follow. And Fairfield follows them to the T. So we reviewed, you know, what the deadlines were, what the parameters were. And then we spent a couple of months, my departments and my administration, working to identify projects that we already had sort of shovel ready, projects that were ready that we could use this money for, because there is a deadline. You know, you have to use it within a specific amount of time.
Sure.
So what we did was we gathered together a bunch of projects, and it went from everything, Melissa, from playgrounds to this thing, the Rooster River. A whole bunch of different projects, $1 million toward our fill pile.
Oh, sure. That was going to be my other question was, do we still have money left over to start working on that? But there you go. You answered it.
I put together a whole list of projects and then brought the list before our Board of Selectmen, which was discussed and voted on, and then went to the Board of Finance and then to the RTM. So all town bodies reviewed everything, and everything is watched closely. But we did have some money put away for a flood and erosion, and specifically some mitigation efforts. So there was money in there, and it was outlined under that header. So it wasn't as if we, you know, took some playground money and decided to use it.
Right.
You know, for the sand spit. So this actually worked out perfectly when this came up, because we had the money in there for this type of activity. So it worked out perfect.
Okay. And Brenda, just really quickly, I just had one more question for you. I know that you said this is going to be continuing on, I would think, for some time, but have they already started with the flood prevention projects? And do you know ballpark how long it's going to take to get it all complete?
So are you talking about the Rooster River project?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, the Rooster River. I apologize. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, unfortunately, you know, there's so many regulatory agencies you have to go through for these types of projects. And actually, we had everything set up. And we, like I said, we had this project ready to go. It was fully engineered, ready to go. the town of Fairfield had it before I even came into office. So when those ARPA funds came in and I knew that those neighborhoods were getting flooded up, that was one of the first projects I said we need to address. So we put the $3.2 million in. Our engineering department has been working closely with, you know, you have to go through permitting process with DEEP. But now we've just been told that they're kind of raising the bar about the parameters. So instead of sort of the 100-year flood, you know, you have to build it to 100-year or 500-year. If you've heard those terms you'd be used in regulatory, now they're saying we just got word Friday that they want us to, the Army Corps of Engineers want us to build to a 1,000-year flood.
Oh, wow.
And that's going to slow it up a bit. And actually, I've never even heard of that. So I talked to Mayor Ganim about it yesterday. And I said, are you aware of this change? And he said he wasn't, because it just came out and our engineering department just got alerted to it. So I said to him, I think we need to huddle up and talk about this, because it could potentially delay this project by a year.
Oh, okay.
When we were pretty much ready to go. So,
wow.
Again, you know, regulations, regulatory. So we'll see what we can do. We're going to talk to the governor about it and see if we can sort of move this along quicker than what's apparently going to be delaying it a bit.
Yeah, that would be great. And certainly, Brenda, you know, keep us posted. We'd love to, you know, stay on top of this. I know it impacts a lot of our listeners. And again, just
it
love
really
the fact
does.
That it's being addressed. Yeah.
Well, I'm excited that we're able to do it finally. These people have been waiting a really long time for some relief, and I'm trying to deliver it for them.
Well, I appreciate it, and certainly so do our listeners. And Brenda Kupchick, we thank you so much for giving us the details and for coming on this morning and chatting with us about it. Thank you.
All right, Melissa, you have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Welcome back. We've got 80 degrees today, so I imagine that's because you brought it back with you from Florida.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, there was no shock. No temperature shock from going from Florida back to here. Yeah, it's nice to see 80 degrees here. It's wonderful, especially since this week is the kids off from school. So, hey, you know, get out here before the storm is rolling this afternoon and take advantage of the zoo. We really appreciate people coming out.
It's so true, Greg. I was sad I missed you last week. I mean, we've missed you on the show. I had listeners who thought I bumped you from the show. I was like, why would I get rid of our best segment? Why would I do that? But Chase and I went to the zoo last Friday, and it was gorgeous, Greg. We were there for almost 3 hours, which is like a max for. I mean, Chase can't even stay, you know, at an amusement park for longer than an hour and a half. I mean, it was a perfect day. It was perfect.
Oh, that's love to hear that.
Yeah,
love to hear that. That is just tremendous. Yeah, and so we have good news today too.
I was going to say when we were there, we were told that when we saw the pigs, they were very pregnant. They were very, very pregnant, and we have piglets now on property. How exciting!
We do. You know, there's I got four grandchildren. There's Lucas, Wesley, Isla, and Ada. And
oh,
one of the
beautiful
things that, as a grandparent, you always do is this little piggy, you know,
went to market.
This little piggy
of
stayed home. This little piggy, you know. So how many piggies do we have? We have 5 piggies.
No way.
So isn't that cool?
Oh, my gosh. I
so
love that.
We actually do with our piggies.
So
Harry Plopper, our elected mayor, you know, remember that. He is the elected Zoo mayor.
I do remember,
And one of the females, which is Ethel, she had what we call as 2.3 babies. Well, and that is zoo notations.
Is that based on the size?
It's based on male. It's the males first, females second, which we won't say anything, but and then unknowns. So that's when you put down notations for animals in the collection, it's 2.3. So we have 2 males, 3 females. If it was 2.3.1, then it would be 2 males, 2 females, 3 females, and
unknown
one.
I gotcha.
Right.
Okay.
So we have 5 babies. They're the coolest thing because baby pigs, especially baby guinea hogs, we've had them in the past. The first time we actually had them, we were so excited. But when they're born, they're so precocious that they don't sit with mom and say, okay, we're just going to stay with mom for a couple, 3 weeks and nurse and get bigger and get protected. No. They just take off.
They're gone with
they
the wind.
They just take off.
Bye.
They're little,
we're done.
little tiny pigs, and they just bug, and they're all over the place. And we actually had to protect them because they were getting outside the old pen. They're walking outside with the public, and we were like, "Oh, gee, putting them back inside." It was a pretty crazy time. But they are so cute. They are just the cutest thing, and they grow so fast. Guinea hogs are an endangered species. People don't realize
that. These are
animals that are actually are heritage breeds. And being heritage breeds means that they were brought over to this country for family farms, for backyard farms.
Okay.
They were brought over on the boats because they were small. They don't get very large. The guinea hogs will get to be about 125, 150 pounds. So they're relatively small pigs. And so they don't eat a lot. And they have a lot of babies. Again, as you see, they had five babies. This is a relatively young pig too. Ethel is not very old.
Wow.
And so you have a lot of progeny from them. So they're great for a family farm, but we're a family farm. So they're not really around anymore. So these animals became non-used. Why have a pig that doesn't get very big? So they were actually becoming an endangered species.
Oh my gosh,
and really, really proud
that.
Here at Connecticut Spiritsley Zoo that we were able to bring these pigs. We worked with the Heritage Breed Association, the Minor Breed Association, Livestocks, and said these were on a hazard condition, that they were in a red zone right now.
Wow.
So working with them, we were able to actually start having baby pigs born here with the guinea hogs and then get them to go to other facilities. So we actually were very helpful in getting the guinea hog off the critically endangered list of these minor breeds or heritage breeds. So we're really proud about that. We're really great to have baby pigs again because they are just the cutest things on the planet. And that's not only Ethel had the five babies, but now we have Doris, which is the other female pig.
I was going to say you have another pig, yeah.
And she is ready to have babies any day now,
Gosh.
So a lot of people think of spring and they think of the zoo. Always thought of the zoo as in spring, come to see the new babies at the zoo. We don't have babies at the zoo just to have babies. That's not what we do here at the zoo. We don't say, okay, we need a lot of babies for the spring, so we have people come visit us. That's not what we do. Only animals that aren't in need to have offspring, we have babies being born. So this is just fortuitous that it is spring. These aren't still a critical. They're still in critical or endangered species. So we do want to have offspring from them. But again, we're not having the babies in the spring just to have babies, but we're happy to have them anyway.
Oh, I think it's so exciting. And as you heard Greg mention, there is another pig that is pregnant and due any day now. So it's really exciting. Now, do they coexist with each other? Like, do all the piglets coexist with each other?
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. The two moms get along very well.
Oh, good.
However, Harry Plopper had to be, he is now living next to our Dexter cows over on the other side of the New England farmyard, because the males can get a little aggressive.
Oh, okay.
So there's just no reason to have him there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's now been relegated to next to the Dexter cows, which is kind of fun. He's actually interacting with them over there, which is kind of fun to
watch.
He's
probably campaigning. Look, he wants to be reelected.
Well,
I get
is.
It. Yeah. He wants
is.
Another
campaign.
Term. I get
campaigning
it.
Never stops, does it? I believe
no.
that is the truth. Yep.
Exactly.
So
he's
again,
just talking to his
everybody
constituents.
Can come up to the zoo. Come up to the zoo. Do your this little piggy went to market with our five little baby pigs. And again, it's just we're really happy about seeing this because it's always good to see babies at the zoo.
I agree.
Anytime.
I agree. Those five little piggies went wee 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 right to the Beardsley Zoo.
Right to Beardsley Zoo.
Oh, Greg Dancho. Well, welcome
everybody
back. Thank
you so much. Everybody take a look at our Facebook page and website because we're bringing back the Wild Wine Safari this year. It's been on hiatus due to COVID, but it's coming back this year. This is the first big party of the summer. So June 4th, we'll be at the zoo with wine and food. And so take a look on our website and join the fun. We're really excited to bring people back for this really, really premier event for us.
Yeah, that's been gone for a couple of years now, so that's very exciting news. All right, great. Well, Greg, welcome back from Florida. And wow, what a welcome to have piglets here to go, Greg, we're here. It's so good to see you. Hi, welcome back. So exciting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. That's Greg Dancho of the Beardsley Zoo here on WICC.